In the last minutes of this sitting, I would like to read for you the Mahayana Sutra that the Dalai Lama was teaching on this last days. And it's called, usually called just the Heart Sutra, sometimes called the Great Wisdom Beyond Wisdom Heart Sutra. It's one of the very, it's a short discourse attributed to the Buddha that is among the most popular and most important central discourses in much of Mahayana Buddhism of Tibet, East Asia, Japan. It has philosophical import, but it's also understood to be somewhat of like a mantra. It gets recited daily, for example, in Zen monasteries over and over again. And it's not so much the teaching, the philosophy that's important, but rather the way that the way the words kind of condition the mind, little explosions in the mind, little challenges to conventional understanding. So during the end of the sitting, I'd like to read it. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. When practicing deeply the perfection of insight, perceive that all five skandhas in their own being are empty and was saved from all suffering. O Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness, form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness. O Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They do not appear nor disappear, are not tainted nor pure, do not increase nor decrease. Therefore, in emptiness, no form, no feelings, no perceptions, no formations, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of eyes, until no realm of mind consciousness, no ignorance, and also no extinction of it, until no old age and death, and also no extinction of it, no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path, no cognition, also no attainment. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva depends on the perfection of insight, and the mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fear exists. Far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. In the three worlds, all Buddhas depend on the perfection of insight and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Therefore, know the perfection of insight mantra is the great transcendent mantra, is the great bright mantra, is the utmost mantra, is the supreme mantra, which is able to relieve all suffering and is true, not false. So proclaim the perfection of insight mantra. Proclaim the mantra that says, Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha. So I went to the Dalai Lama on his talks at the Shoreline Amphitheater on Thursday and Friday. I didn't go yesterday. And it was very moving to be there among some, 6,000-7,000 people with tremendous kind of joy and devotion to both to Buddhism but also to this figure of the Dalai Lama. I think a lot of people were there partly to get the teachings, but partly just to be in his presence. Many people see him as kind of their hero. He's kind of one of my heroes. He seems like a wonderful advocate of nonviolence and a wonderful person of great compassion and patience and seeming very universal, ecumenical kind of teaching, offering a lot of respect to all religions. And he gave some wonderful teachings on this Heart Sutra, and some of the teachings were quite profound, or I think for some people quite difficult to follow. It was difficult for me to follow at times what he was teaching, because he went over, he reviewed kind of the whole history of how the teaching of emptiness has been developed in the history of Indian Tibetan Buddhism, and then how it relates perhaps to understanding the Heart Sutra. And the philosophy of emptiness is one of the most developed and sophisticated, and at times difficult to understand teachings that Buddhism has to offer. So to kind of review it all at the Shoreland Amphitheater for everyone was Shoreland Amphitheater was quite empty. It was just wonderful to be out there under the empty skies. So kind of in honor of that and kind of inspired by that, I thought I would give a talk on the Heart Sutra. I don't understand it to the depth of the Dalai Lama understands it. I thought that kind of it was on my mind and it seemed like a nice thing to do. So it's a relatively short sutra. I read it for you. It goes very quick, and it's one of the reasons perhaps why it's so chanted in liturgically in many, many Mahayana Buddhist schools. And you can chant it, very quickly. In fact, in the Zen monasteries where I was at, the young 20-year-old monks would train themselves or kind of compete. There was kind of like a source of pride was to be able to chant the whole thing on one breath. Take a really deep breath and just let it rip. Exactly what the genesis of the sutra is not so clear. If you hear from a very traditional teacher like the Dalai Lama, they'll give you the very traditional understanding of it coming out of the mouth of the Buddha and the context and setting in which it was taught by the Buddha. If you listen to Buddhist scholars, they'll point out that no way it could have been written by the historical Buddha. It was probably composed many, many centuries later. And that you can kind of trace and discover its origin in a larger sutra that's called the Large Sutra of Perfect Wisdom, which English translation, somewhat abbreviated, is this big. And there's a section in here that is the kind of middle two-thirds of the Heart Sutra. And it seems like at some point the Heart Sutra, that section was extracted from this text. And then a beginning and ending was added onto it. And the various beginning and endings were added on to it. That was quite fluid, beginnings and endings of it, the context that was provided for it. But the central core doctrinal part of it more or less comes out of here. And the advantage of reading this one in here is that it gives a wider doctrinal context for this little pithy discourse. Because there's more, the context, what's being, the flow of the conversation is in this big text here. the core teaching of the Heart Sutra is usually described pretty simply, and I'll describe that. Though it's elaborated in all kinds of ways. And in a sense, the Heart Sutra has been described as a mirror, that what Buddhists over the centuries tend to do is they take this mirror and it really reflects themselves. They take whatever teachings that they want or they have and they kind of find it in the Heart Sutra. And so over the centuries you find many, many different teachings on the Heart Sutra and they all kind of vary a little bit. Some are quite opposed to each other. In Japan, in the modern world, there were people who wrote, took the Heart Sutra as being a political text. And there was one man who made a commentary on the Heart Sutra where he was basically quoting Joseph Stalin and showing how it was a kind of communist kind of interpretation of Heart Sutra. And there were other people in Japan who took, because Heart Sutra is like one of the most important religious texts in Japan. So it's, you know, people commented a lot. And someone else, you know, took it to be an anti-communist trek. You know, and there are all kinds of ways in which people then will interpret it. And it kind of lends itself. It's kind of a little bit like an inkblot. It kind of lends itself to a wide variety of interpretations. Even though there tends to be a kind of central orthodox way of beginning that interpretation. And perhaps the interpretation of the text is less important historically than its function as a mantra. The word heart has sometimes been translated as meaning core, the core teachings of the perfection of wisdom, which is this big. Let's kind of narrow it down. And so the central kind of teaching. The other meaning which historically has had, the word heart, hridaya, it meant mantra. And so this was the mantra of the perfection of wisdom and the perfection of insight. And a mantra, has other, you know, other functions besides its doctrinal function. It has its meaning as a kind of an incantation, as a magical or sacred spell, or it has a kind of the intonation of it has some kind of psychological effect on the person who chants it or hears it. And that psychological effect, and sometimes that kind of effect it has on the wider world. For example, mantras sometimes are used as protections, protecting you from dangers. So it has some kind of psychological protective sometimes functions. And then this is one of the ways then it's been used over the centuries. And probably the origins of the Heart Sutra as a separate text, separate from this here, was probably more like a mantra. One scholar has a very provocative article that's it's fantastic detective work. And it's pretty, you know, it's hard to refute what she's come up with. However, in Japan, kind of fundamentalist Buddhists are furious at her for coming up with this. And you'll understand in a moment. It's clear that, from the point of view of scholars, that the Heart Sutra comes from this larger text. Coming from this larger text, when was it taken out of this larger text, and when was the beginning and endings, the context of the text, added to it? Through a lot of careful detective work on texts and surviving texts, all different versions of the Heart Sutra and the versions of this larger text, what she concludes is that the only way you can explain all the evidence is by saying that that work of pulling the Heart Sutra out of this larger text happened in China. And it happening in China, it happened after it was translated into Chinese. And then someone, and she speculates with Xuanzang himself, the famous Chinese pilgrim to India, someone in China brought it back to India as a short little text to chant for protection. And the person probably was surprised to discover that they couldn't find it in India. So that person then probably translated it back into Sanskrit, or Sanskrit into Sanskrit. And then it had a life of its own, and it evolved in India, and then eventually was brought back into China as a Sanskrit Buddhist text. Now, this, of course, is, you know, height of heresy to call it this, because if it's not Indian, then it's not really, you know, it's like saying that the Gospels were written in England. So it has this, you know, interesting history. So, but the origin seems to be more of a protective text. And when you chant this every day in Zen monasteries, you know, people don't think so much regularly about the teaching of it, but rather they let it kind of impact, almost a subconscious. You chant these words over and over again, and no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, and it kind of like a little mind explosion. What does that mean? Or kind of like puts to rest kind of that part, you know. Of course I have eyes and ears, and what does this mean? Or just kind of silences the mind for a moment, or kind of silences the conventional way of looking at things. And people chant it every day, then it'll memorize, it'll be deeply memorized in their mind. And then it'll reappear at various points and remind them something, or a new, like a poem that kind of suddenly has a new understanding, or helps you see life in a new perspective. So it kind of adds to, kind of enriches life in the way a poem is memorized might enrich a life. So it might be kind of unfair to look at the text too much as a doctrinal text, but rather to look at it more as a poem or as a, its function in Buddhist communities, as a mantra, as a chant, as an evocative text. And from that point of view, you know, even understanding it doctrinally maybe kind of takes you away from its evocative functions. However, one of the things I love about the Heart Sutra is that the whole context of it is in the context of compassion. The opening word is referring to Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara is the great bodhisattva of compassion. In India, he was a he. In China, he eventually became a she. And in America, at least among Japanese Zen students, she is definitely a she. As a rather androgynous figure in China that kind of became more and more female, eventually became a woman. But it's the bodhisattva of great compassion. And so it's the kind of archetype of compassion. And that's evoked in the beginning. The whole thing is addressed to the bodhisattva path. And the whole bodhisattva path is a path that based itself on compassion. To be concerned with the compassionate response to the suffering of the world. And to orient one's life, one's whole life, around this principle of compassion towards help the world around it. So this whole text has its foundation, has its root or context in the notion of compassion. And when you listen to it or read it, it's nice to think about that, to be reminded of compassion as really the purpose of why the text was even composed or why it's been chanted or why the Buddha spoke it, if you see it from that point of view. Actually, it's not the Buddha who spoke it, but Buddha was part of one scene, one of the contexts for the text. And then it says, Avalokiteshvara, when practicing deeply the Prajna Paramita. Prajna Paramita means perfection, or it means that which is most ultimate, sometimes means, or that which refers to crossing over to the other shore. And Paramita usually translated into English as perfection. And Prajna, often in English translated as wisdom, but it might actually, some people will argue, better translated as insight. I'm not the only one who makes that argument. Because wisdom has maybe has connotations of intuitive wisdom or understanding wisdom you get from life experience. Insight has the sense that it's much more immediacy than wisdom. Wisdom is something you carry along with you. You bring a bag of wisdom with you. But insight is something that happens in the moment. You see clearly the nature of something. And in seeing clearly the nature of something, you're liberated from that thing, or you find your freedom. And prajna is this immediate, clear insight into the nature of reality, into the nature of something. It's not a wisdom you carry with you from the past. Not that you had some wisdom, and now you apply this wisdom to all kinds of situations. Rather, the insight is renewed each time you see something new. You see very clearly something about everything. So that seeing is called an insight. So it's arguable whether it should be insight or wisdom or what, but I kind of prefer insight. And so the Avalokiteshvara was practicing this practice of the perfection of insight. Was practicing insight into seeing things in a particular way. And in doing that, Avalokiteshvara perceived that, so because it's an insight, perceived, all five skandhas in their own being are empty and was saved from all suffering. The five skandhas are the five aggregates that the Buddha used, the five clumps, the five categories the Buddha used to divide up the psychophysical human being. Who you are as a human being can be described, can be divided up into these five categories, grouping of things. And according to the Buddha, you won't find anything in your experience of who you are that's outside of these five categories. Everything you can experience about yourself can be understood to occur within these five categories. And like in English, we say maybe everything who you are is in the mind or in the body, or the mind, the body, and the heart. You have these categories. So in ancient India, that had five categories, and everything goes into that. And those five categories our form, our physical form, the experience of physicality that we have, the feeling tone of the experience, and that's understood to be the pleasant, unpleasant, neutrality of the experience, the perception that we have of our experience, perception is maybe not the best translation, but the recognition, the apperception, when you apperceive something, this is a book, that's a perception, and that capacity of the mind to perceive what our world is around, what world is, our experience of the world, very kind of basic, unelaborated perception, book, not what book it is and what I think of the book, but just facing this as a book, for example. And then mental formations. The whole inner world of dispositions, of intentions, of ideas, of thoughts, of values. It's a big clumping of who we are, which is summarized under this title called mental formations. And finally, consciousness. Consciousness is an important part of the psychophysical human being. Those are the five categories of who we are, and everything's supposed to be able to fit neatly within that. And maybe you just have to take that as being kind of just, you know, they're just kind of, maybe we could abstract categories which are useful for organizing, just like mind and body is useful to organize, or mind, body, and heart, or whatever way we want to do it. And we don't have to take them to be absolute, just like we don't take the metric system to be more absolute than the English system of, you know, just a way of kind of dividing things up. But in that it's divided up this way, the psychophysical human being, Avalokiteshvara sees that these five things, these five aspects of who we are empty in their own being and was saved from all suffering. The whole purpose of Buddhism, Buddhist practice, is to be saved from all suffering. So that's kind of like, you know, when you hear that, that's what it took. All Buddhists kind of wake up right away. Wow, you know, that's what I'm all about. That's what it's all about. My suffering, other people's suffering. And great, I mean, this is really significant. This is what it took for Avalokiteshvara to be freed of all suffering. What did it take? By perceiving all the aspects of our psychophysical being, everything who we are, to see it as being empty of own being, of intrinsic, inherent existence. See it as not existing in and of itself with inherent, permanent existence. So that's a powerful statement. And so what does that mean? The text then goes on, and here Avalokiteshvara is telling the rest of the text, Avalokiteshvara is speaking, and telling this to Shariputra, which has some significance because Shariputra was understood at that time in India as being the great expounder of the Abhidharma. He was the one who kind of taught or systematized or held or was the transmitter of the Abhidharma. He was the Buddhist disciple who had the most philosophical, psychological inclination, kind of putting everything to categories and analyzing everything to death, a great analysis of Indian Buddhism. So here's Avalokiteshvara teaching something. Sariputta was understood to have this great wisdom because he could analyze everything. And here, Avalokiteshvara is teaching Sariputta what he doesn't know, even though he knows everything. And what she's doing, she's going to pull the rug from underneath all the categories, main categories of analysis that's associated with Shariputra. O Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness, form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. So all these five categories of the human being have this nature of being empty. But emptiness is not different from these. So what this means is that emptiness is a characteristic of who we are, of all the aspects of who we are, a characteristic of all the aspects of who we are. Anything we can point to, this is who I am, or this is an aspect of who I am, whether it's kind of generally or whether it's, you know, kind of just, you know, in any kind of way you want to say it, has a characteristic of being empty. In the same way that we say that the characteristic of water is that it's wet. Water is wet, and wetness is water. We don't find water separate from wetness, and we don't find, I guess you have other things that are wet besides water, but you don't find wetness separate from water or from liquid or something. heat is not separate from fire, fire is not separate from heat. Something like that. It's a characteristic. So emptiness is a characteristic of things in that same way. So you're not going to find emptiness separate from things because it's a characteristic. A characteristic is not apart from that which is a characteristic of. Does that make sense? So emptiness is a characteristic in that sense. And it's one of the very important warnings because a lot of Buddhists take emptiness as being this thing in and of itself that's apart from everything, like a transcendental reality. Or you can look at emptiness and see it as a thing separate from everything else. I see emptiness. Emptiness, you can't see emptiness apart from seeing everything else, because emptiness is a characteristic of things. So this is really emphatic. Form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. And the same is true of everything else. Now, and then it goes on, O Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. So it's not just simply all aspects of our psychophysical being, but all dharmas here means everything. Everything is marked with emptiness. All dharmas, all things, and then this is kind of where it begins to be a little bit more challenging for us, for conventional understanding. All things, all dharmas, are marked with emptiness. They do not appear nor disappear, are not tainted nor pure, do not increase nor decrease. Now, what does it mean, they do not appear nor disappear? I was, those of you who sat the first sitting this morning noticed that I suddenly appeared. I wasn't here for the first sitting. And if you stay long enough, you'll notice that I disappear. There's a lot of things we notice rise and disappear. Indian religion was very concerned about purity and impurity. So here it says, are not tainted nor pure. Things are not tainted or pure. Do not increase nor decrease. Over the years, you probably noticed that I've gained a little bit of weight. I'm certainly increasing. So what does it mean? It says that there's an increase. It's great for weight problems. Unless you have a lot of weight, then it says no decrease. And that's not very helpful. So what does all this mean? And this is a matter of, then interpretation. I don't know. The text doesn't really explain to us very well. Even with the help of this large text, it's a little bit hard to understand exactly what it means. And whenever something's hard to really understand what it means, when it's kind of vague or kind of just brushstroke kind of descriptions, it lends itself to religious commentators going to town and having all kinds of wonderful interpretations. All dharmas are marked with emptiness. Marked means they have the characteristic of emptiness. So, as I said earlier, the characteristic of emptiness is not separate from that which it characterizes. So if you want to see emptiness, you have to see the thing that you're looking at also. Emptiness means, in this text, what it means, here in this text it actually words it a little bit differently, this very same passage. And it's a little bit clearer, perhaps, what it could mean. The Bodhisattva does not review. Review means kind of consider, does not think about, does not kind of actively kind of see or frame form, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness, the psychophysical being, as either subject to production or subject to stopping. That's another same way of saying appearing and disappearing. He does not review form as either subject to defilement or as subject to purification. The Bodhisattva does not review form as connected with feeling. Feeling is connected with form. Feeling is connected with perception. Perception is connected with feeling. And why? Because no things connects any other thing, nor does it disconnect. It is not joined nor disjoined on account of the emptiness of their essential original nature. That which is emptiness, that is not form. So there's something here about reviewing. So we don't want to consider what is. We don't consider something as arising and passing away, as appearing or disappearing. What this means, I believe, is that it points to the phenomenal human capacity to attribute characteristics to things that are not there. Emptiness is understood to be a real characteristic of the way things actually are. But we have an amazing ability to apply, to characterize things in ways that are not there. And one of the common ways that the Theravada tradition points to is we characterize things as somehow relating to the self. So it starts off with a psychophysical being, the five aggregates of self, and we often attribute that this is who I am. This defines me in some way. And what it's saying here is we cannot use these to define ourselves in any absolute way. The word here is used over and over again, in their own being, an intrinsic original nature, no inherent existence. So do we take things personally or not? When we take things personally, we are characterizing this as having some personal relationship to who I am. It's not inappropriate to do that, but we often then add a little characteristic that this is actually defines us in some absolute way. Or even if we don't do that step, we relate to it as something which has some permanence that we can either cling to or relate to as trying to push away. So if I get angry, I could take it personally. I'm the one who's getting angry. Of course I am. I have to take responsibility for that. But I can use that to define myself. I can still take responsibility of the anger being there without taking it personally, saying this defines who I am. And because when I take it personally, then I get entangled with it. If I don't take it personally, I just see it as a phenomenon that arises. And all the various associated ideas and characteristics that I add to that don't happen. I don't get embarrassed. I don't get angry with myself. I don't feel like, well, I need to justify my anger now. Let's get a really good philosophy of why I'm angry now. The fact that I'm angry because I feel frustrated, I won't tell them that. I'll tell them I'm angry because I'm going into a whole rationalization of the situation. If I don't take it personally, then there's less need to do much about it. You can see the anger there and actually be freer with the anger there, or the fear, whatever it might be. So we tend to impute characteristics on our experience which maybe are not there. And by pointing to the emptiness, the Mahayana tradition is trying to point to the fact trying to undercut or pull the rug from underneath a lot of the normal ways in which we impute characteristics onto our experience. You following me? One of the most common ways of explaining the Heart Sutra is that everything is impermanent, everything's in constant change, and everything arises in dependence on other things. Because it arises in dependence on other things, things arise because of causes and conditions. Things don't exist in and of themselves. Things are conditioned. Things arise in dependence on other things. And that explains the Heart Sutra saying things don't exist in their own nature. Because they don't exist in and of themselves, they have no absolute permanent thingness in the thing. There's no inherent, there's no inherent chair in the chair. A chair is in a sense, a characteristic we apply to this piece of plastic that's shaped a certain way. It was made to be that way, probably. The inventor and the maker had this in mind. But still, it's a characteristic we add to this chair. You can easily apply a different characteristic to the chair. You can decide it's a stepping stool, or a doorstop, or all kinds of other things. It can be, if they have enough of them around, you can make it into a fort, the walls of a fort, as a three-year-old might do. I lost track of my thought, but that's okay, since it's all nothing. So the most common way of understanding in the Heart Sutra is that all things arise in dependence on everything else, and has no inherent existence by itself. It arises in dependence on causes and conditions. And one of the important causes and conditions for the world we live in, walk around in and relate to, is how we relate to it, what we apply to it, the characteristics we apply. And we often don't see the degree to which we paint our reality with our descriptions of what's actually there. And you might say, well, of course that's a chair. But is it, of course, a chair? Because it could be something else in other situations. And because, this is continuing the normal logic that Mahayana philosophers have, because it has no absolute inherent existence in and of itself, you cannot call it an I, you cannot call an I an I. You cannot call a body a body. Because it doesn't exist in any permanent absolute way. So that seems kind of like deflates. Seems like, to me it's kind of like anticlimactic to say it that way. Because you have this wonderful teaching, this punchline that goes, in emptiness, no form, no feeling, no perceptions, no formations, no consciousness. I mean, people then go, but I have those things. What do you mean? No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. But this is crazy. I mean, of course I have nose and eyes and ears. What are they telling me there's none of these things? Well, in emptiness, from the point of view of emptiness, when you see things as not being, when you actually can see that things arise because of causes and conditions, it's obvious to you then that they have no inherent existence by themselves. And as not having an inherent existence by themselves, in that sense they don't exist. They exist in some conventional way as, you know, a stream of things arising and passing, but they don't exist in and of themselves. No smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of eyes, until no realm of mind consciousness. No ignorance, and also no extinction of it. No old age and death, and also no extinction of it. This is in brief outline the 12 steps of dependent origination, one of the central teachings. What they're doing here is undercutting some of the central teachings of the Buddha and some of the central categories that you find in the four foundations of mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta, which in Vipassana students are supposed to actually see all these things. And here they're saying these don't exist. They're not there in some way. No eyes. So the 12 links of dependent origination. And then it goes on and does the same thing with the Four Noble Truths. No suffering, no cause of suffering, no ending of suffering, and no path to the ending of suffering, the Four Noble Truths. So great. I mean, here I'm devoted myself to Buddhism and finally had these wonderful teachings and the path and saying these things don't exist in some way. You know, so it's kind of a shock. You can imagine Shariputra, who's been believing in this and being really dedicated to the Four Noble Truths and carrying them around as his really important teaching and the path, that he's following the Eightfold Path. And then Avalokiteshvara says, there is no. You know, and not only that, there's no suffering. What do you mean there's no suffering? That's the whole reason I'm doing this whole thing. I've spent my whole adult life engaged in Buddhism because I suffer and I want to get free of suffering. And you tell me there's no suffering? So it has a certain shock value, this text, until you get into the explanation of it and say, oh, that's what they mean. Oh, no inherent existence. Oh, fine. Now I understand, of course. But, that doesn't really relate to me, but no inherent existence. And then it goes on to say, no cognition, and also no attainment. No attainment. I mean, that's really, I mean, it's fine. All these other things are fine to have Noah. But no attainment. I mean, that's the whole point of it, is to have some kind of attainment to relate to. But even some attainment has no inherent existence. It doesn't exist in and of itself, but it arises independent of causes and conditions. And it passes with the changing of causes and conditions. And then it goes on to say, with nothing to attain. So this is a big shift in logic here. Because early on it says, these things don't exist in and of themselves in an inherent way. But if that's the case, then the bodhisattva has nothing to attain. It's a little bit of a jump of logic. Because you can say, well, these things exist conventionally as things that arise independent of causes and conditions. So you can still go for them. You can still try to attain this thing that doesn't have an inherent existence. Like your television show has no inherent existence, right? It's just there because you turn on the television and electricity is working. But there is no real, as essential nature, there is no television program, and the people on television, the actors, there's no inherent, characters there. They're just things that appear as because of like the way electricity and light works on your television screen. So But they still exist somehow. You can still enjoy them. You still make a television show. But here, with nothing to attain, with no attainment, with nothing to attain. So the Bodhisattva understands the emptiness in such a way that the Bodhisattva has nothing to attain. And that is phenomenally challenging to people who engage in Buddhist practice, because everybody who practices wants to have some kind of attainment, wants something, to get something from it. Suffer less, get calmer, more peaceful, more compassionate, something. If there's no attainment, you know, you might as well stay home and watch television. You know, why waste your time? With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva depends on prajna paramita. Bodhisattva depends on the perfection of insight. And in doing that, the mind is no hindrance. The mind is no hindrance. This is very... Depending on the perfection of insight, the mind is no longer a hindrance. That's a very important line. The mind is no longer a hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. Far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. In the three worlds, all Buddhas depend on the perfection of insight and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Far apart from every perverted view means all the perverted ways in which we impute characteristics in reality which are not really inherently there. There's an imputation of permanence. Even if we don't have philosophical idea that everything's absolutely permanent forever, we impute that somehow this is actually is how things are for the time being. It has some permanence in the moment or in the minute or in the hour or in the year. That's considered a perverted view. We have the perverted view that this thing somehow can be taken personally. It defines who I am in some absolute way. We have the perverted view that things have some aspect of pleasure or happiness are inherent in things. And it's considered to find happiness in the things of the world is considered to be a perverted view. And that's very challenging for those of us who expect happiness to come from the things of the world. And certainly things can be pleasant and be pleasure associated with them, and maybe some kind of worldly happiness can be associated with them. But to impute the characteristic, oh, that's going to make me happy. That's what it takes to be happy. That thing itself is happiness making. That thing itself is happy. Is considered a perverted view. So that's a very challenging... Again, this text is supposed to be challenging many of the conventional ways in which we understand our life. In that a person is apart from these perverted views, not connected to them anymore, not involved with them, the person dwells in nirvana. Somehow, not having these perverted views is a definition of living in liberation. And this whole text is pointing towards the possibility of full liberation, saved from all suffering in the beginning. To go back a little bit, the mind is no hindrance. That was the really... Having this insight into the perfection of wisdom, it brings the mind to have no hindrance. The central cause of our suffering, the central cause of our enslavement in Buddhism, is what we do with our own mind. And Buddhists have to take responsibility for what they do. We have to take responsibility for how we contribute to our suffering, to the suffering of the world. If we suffer... Even if the conditions and causes of our suffering are in the world around us, those are the conditions for it. They're not the cause. The cause is not the conditions. The cause is what our mind does. If someone says that your mother wears army boots, and then you get angry and upset and depressed because of that, conventionally you might say that person caused my unhappiness for saying something about my mother. But it has a lot to, the real cause is not what the person said, but the fact that you received that statement in a way that your mind contracted. And if you feel like kind of stabbing of your heart because of that, it's because you stabbed yourself, not because of the words that were said. So there's some way in which we receive the experience of the world and then personalize it, react to it, get involved in it, we cling to it, we get attached, which causes our suffering. In the text here, it seems to relate to this to the notion of fear. Maybe for this text, the person who wrote it, fear is really the fundamental cause of suffering. The Buddha didn't say that, but it's tied for first place. So without the mind is no hindrance. The mind has no hindrance. The mind does not contract. The mind does not see things in the way things are not. Somehow the mind is freed. And in freeing the mind from its tendency to cling, to react, to have aversion, to close down on, that is what frees us then from the perverted views and frees us to experience nirvana. This text continues to claim that all Buddhas, everyone who's been enlightened, has depended on this perfection of insight for their enlightenment. This perfection of insight is to see things, all things, as being empty, and having characteristic of emptiness. Emptiness means it has no permanent characteristics. If you see something arising and passing, so if you're watching a movie, this classic example, and you think there's real people up there, and you get involved, start crying and angry and whatever what's going on the movie screen, and if for some reason they start slowing down the projector, really slow, and so there's one frame, every 10 seconds. Or every minute, you'll start noticing, oh, there's no person up there. There's nothing. It's just, it's individual shots happening one at a time. There's no person there arising and passing away. There's no change, no appearance and disappearance in the sense of changing over time. There's a shot, there's a frame, and that frame is a particular way. Then there's another frame, and that's a particular way. And you can't really say something arises and passes, it just is what it is for the moment. And you don't impute the characteristics of a human being who's making choices up there on the screen and acting a certain way or is permanent in some way. But you see very clearly that it's empty of that kind of inherent existence. To have the perfection of insight is to see our experience in the same way. We see that the things don't qualify. The things still exist. There's forms and feelings and thoughts and ideas. But we don't somehow see it as being something that we can, that has the, that, is cap- that we're capable of grasping onto. Most of the function of insight is to show us that anything that we experience doesn't have the characteristic that allows us, makes sense for us, to grasp onto it. And if it doesn't have the characteristic that makes sense for us to grasp onto it, we stop grasping. If we stop grasping, then the mind will no longer create any hindrances, and there's no fear. So the perfection of insight, so then it says, all Buddhas depend on perfection of insight. A bodhisattva depend, I like to translate it as trust. They trust the perfection of insight. Because all these things don't exist in and of themselves, we trust our capacity for insight. We trust our capacity to see clearly for how things actually are. I translate this to mean, we trust our capacity to be aware without any clinging. We trust non-clinging. We trust awareness by itself. We place our trust in awareness. Most of us will, if you think about it a little bit, put our trust in all kinds of places which are maybe inherently untrustable because they're changing. We put our trust in our personality. We put our trust in our words and our clothes and our haircut. We put our trust, and hence we depend on this. We kind of use these things as what's going to help us define us and represent us to the world around us or to ourselves. We think if I take care of these things a certain way, then my life's going to be happier or well. So it means we put our trust in all these things. We put our trust in our bank account, in owning a home or having a nice car, or we put a trust in all kinds of things. We put a trust in our political system and our banking system we put a trust there. We put a trust in the value of defending ourselves and not being really frank. Maybe if I don't really tell people what I'm really feeling, then I'll be safe. So we trust hiding who we are. There's all kinds of things we trust. The perfection of insight is supposed to undercut all the things that we trust and point and say, all you should trust is awareness itself. or at least trust the insight into emptiness of things. This, however, is a little bit, all this I've said so far, can I go on? You guys can leave, anybody can leave at any point. We're late, so, you know, it's okay. It's all empty, so. I hope it's okay to go on. So far, it's kind of been philosophical, doctrinal, the teachings. But I think as we're getting into pointing towards trusting insight, trusting awareness itself, trusting that it's okay not to cling to anything, we're getting into the experiential side or the practice side of Buddhism and of the Heart Sutra itself. And this is where it gets maybe a little bit more mystical. And some teachers then will explain it from more this point of view. To not cling to things requires a tremendous degree of trust. To not cling, because most of us, our whole life is based on clinging. And to trust awareness, just awareness, to trust that somehow, if I just stay aware in this situation, that things will arise, I'll know what to say, I'll know what to think, I'll know what to act. That somehow the innate intelligence of who we are can still function when we're aware. In fact, the innate intelligence functions better when we're aware. But most of us don't trust our innate intelligence. We think we have to figure things out in some way figuring out is part of the innate intelligence, but we kind of relate to our thinking mind as if our thinking mind is going to, if we think about things enough, they're going to fix things. And this is obvious because if you sit down to meditate, pretty quickly you realize how much you can't stop your thinking about things. We have this tremendous drive to think about things. But if you trusted your innate intelligence to know what to do and how to speak, this constant, incessant, overheated tendency to always be thinking things out to the nth degree, or for the 500th time, would be relaxed. To trust our innate intelligence and trust awareness and what arises out of awareness. The Mahayana teachings will emphasize that in the field of awareness that we trust and rest there, there is innate intelligence, and more importantly, there's innate compassion that arises out of that. And that innate compassion then becomes the foundation for much of how we live our lives. So we trust awareness itself. As we trust awareness itself, just being aware of things, we're still aware of things. But we're not, this is where it gets a little bit mystical, you're not thinking about them. You're not reviewing them. You're not analyzing them. You're not thinking, oh, this is my I, this is my whatever, this is my feelings. It just, they arise, but there's a kind of a lack of reviewing going on when we trust awareness in this uncompromising, complete way. It's kind of like you have an eye that sees. And the eye functions quite nicely for most of us without us having to think about this is my eye and the eye is actively seeing. If you have to stop and think, is my eye seeing right now? And how is it seeing and why is it seeing and whose eye is seeing? You know, you're going to miss your sights. I mean, it's kind of like it gets in the way, that kind of consideration. Your eye can function quite fine without having to consider all these kinds of secondary ideas. It's still your eye. It's my eye here. And if you step back and think about it, of course, it's not my eye is not your eye. But the eye functions without having to consider this is my eye. And a lot of things are this kind of similar. Sometimes the analogy of the knife can't cut itself. The knife can't know itself because you can't cut it, you know, can't turn around and cut itself. Unless your lips can't kiss themselves. Your lips can kiss, but they can't kiss themselves. The same way that somehow we cannot know ourselves in the same way. If we know ourselves, it's always knowing ourselves about ourselves, thinking about ourselves, reviewing ourselves, the same way we're reviewing the eyes. It's a step removed from who we are. And if we just are who we are in the acting, in the being, in the way the eyes see, if we really trust awareness radically, our experience of life is that way. There's still eyes, there's still ears, all these things still function. But you're not thinking about them in a way. So there's no eyes, no ears, no nose, there's no color. You're not imputing, you're not seeing these things. You're still acting in the world as if you're acting in the world of all those things. But there's no reviewing or thinking about them. There's a kind of spontaneous experience of grace in the way we go about things. In the way, I mean, my favorite example, which maybe I should stop using, maybe it's not even a good one, is Michael Jordan. You know, at the NBA championship, and the Chicago Bulls are 1 point behind, and there's 15 seconds left in the game, and Michael Jordan has the ball. And if he starts wondering, is this the true self that's going to throw this ball? You know, or, you know, starts reviewing all these things about who he is. Is this a real ball? Is it an empty ball? What's the characteristics of this ball? It just gets in the way. There's a kind of sometimes athletes talk about kind of being in the zone, or kind of being in a state of grace. The mystical realm of trusting awareness is all these things exist. Nothing is denied, except the reviewing of them, the thinking about them in this active way. There can still be thoughts, but the thoughts arise without us doing anything with them, not imputing anything into them. If there is insight into that thoughts arises, then there might be a kind of the insight itself teaching us, this is empty. We see very clearly this is empty. Seeing very clearly the emptiness of whatever arises shows us that we can't cling to this. And as we stop clinging to it, then also, if you do it thoroughly enough, we also stop reviewing it, and we live in the life, in the world, in this mystical way, this free way, where there's no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue. So there's these two different strands, perhaps, of interpreting the Heart Sutra. The philosophical, and then a little bit more the mystical, or the maybe spiritual, or the, you know, from the experience of kind of like grace, from this trusting awareness unconditionally, completely, and then allowing whatever happens in life to happen. It's a dangerous teaching, the mystical teaching, because it can lend itself to antinomian teaching, that everything goes. You can do whatever you want. So it's usually not taught without a lot of caveats and understanding and support, and that, you know, it doesn't mean you can do whatever you want. But there's this kind of mystical side to it. And maybe that's why the text then continues, therefore, know the perfection of insight mantra is the great transcendent mantra. It's a mantra. Wow. You know, so much for philosophy. Is the great bright mantra, is the utmost mantra, is the supreme mantra, which is able to relieve all suffering and is true, not false. It helps. The mantra itself helps relieve suffering. Perhaps its mantric effects, the liturgical effects, the way in which it conditions us and we hear it over and over again, it's kind of like something we concentrate on and let it somehow. It begins kind of helping us let go of the various ways in which we hold on to things in a fast way. And a whole other avenue into the mystical side of trusting awareness is not through insight and understanding and philosophy, but rather is by chanting this chant that over and over again kind of helps us let go, let go, let go. And then we let go thoroughly enough. No eyes, no ears. I have known people who have sat in Dharma talks and listened to a Dharma talk, and the teacher said something like this, you know, you have no eyes, no ears, no face, no body. And in somehow, listening to it in a concentrated mind, they were freed. No face, just it disappeared. So, proclaim the perfection of insight mantra. And there's some disagreement, is the mantra the whole sutra, or is it just the mantra at the very end? But it seems to say it's just the mantra at the end, which summarizes it all. It's a mantra which helps us in this task. Proclaim the mantra that says, gate, gate, bodhi, gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhi, svaha. Gate means gone. Gate, gate, gone, gone. Paragata means, para means like, gone beyond. Para means beyond, or gone to the other shore. The other shore meaning place of liberation. Gone beyond, beyond the world of suffering. Parasamgata, gone completely beyond. Bodhi, Bodhi means awakening. Svaha means hallelujah. And so it's really emphatic. The text ends with all this discussion of emptiness by saying, usually, it should be a kind of like gospel thing. You know, you should all stand up and go, hallelujah. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond. Awake, hallelujah. That's the mantra. So. That's the Heart Sutra. Thank you. At least one explanation of it.